Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, part two of two on the top 12 things I've learned from C.S. Lewis. And Ken, as we mentioned on the last podcast, we had to pare the list down from 25 to 12 just to be able to cover them sufficiently in two podcasts, although you could easily go for five, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I appreciate you doing that. I want to tell our listeners that on my Facebook page, if you're a Facebook friend, I give the whole list there. And Joe, you were very helpful to see if we could make it more manageable. And so this is our second podcast. Let me do just a little bit of a review. I wanted to tell everybody I got a message right before last week's podcast. I sent this list of 25 to my kids, and my daughter Sarah responded. She said, "Dad, this is a great list. I've been reading Lewis since I was a little kid, and all of his writings are special to me. There has never been a book by Lewis that didn't impact me, whether it's fiction or nonfiction." She says, "I wish they would make a show out of the space trilogy, though no doubt it wouldn't be nearly as good as the books." And then she says, "I wish I could have attended a live lecture and seen Lewis quickly put on his hat and grab his things and walk out the door just before he ended his lecture. Love, Sarah." You know, Joe, what's interesting about Lewis is he was shy and had social anxiety. And, you know, he wasn't always easy in social context, but here is a man who may be a universal voice. I mean, I know Catholics and Protestants and Orthodox who read him. You know, sometimes within Protestantism, there's a hot debate between Calvinists and Arminians. I know Calvinists and Arminians who like Lewis. So he's a unique figure. His books sell better 50 years after his death than they did during his time. I think he is a phenomenon. And of course, I wrote an article about the latest movie that came out, The Most Reluctant Convert, which I think is a very good film. You can read about my thoughts about that film on Reflections blog. But Joe, I'll just summarize the six we covered previously, and then we'll dive into our second six.
All right.
One of the things I learned from Lewis was connecting reason to truth and imagination to meaning. Again, Lewis is well known for that idea that reason is the organ of truth and imagination is the organ of meaning. Lots of Lewis scholars write about that. Two, that real intellectual ability is to take complex subjects and explain them clearly and simply. Lewis points out in his article, Christian Apologetics, that, you know, if you can't explain things in uneducated language, then maybe you don't understand them as well as you ought to. I've tried to take that to heart in my own writing and teaching. A third point is that Christianity, a powerful way of illustrating the truth of Christianity is showing that it has explanatory power and scope. Last time we talked about Lewis's quote about the sun, "I know that sun exists not just because I can see it, but because the sun provides light, I see everything else." God, Christ, seems to give that kind of explanatory power to us. Four, that a person's profound longing for meaning and transcendence, this is the argument from desire, can be seen as a pointer to God, that this yearning that seems to be universal for something more is well explained in Christianity. Number five, that atheistic naturalism cannot be true in Lewis's mind, because as a worldview, it cannot properly ground reason and human rationality in a way that guarantees truth. Again, that's a controversial argument, but essentially Lewis is taking the view that a viable worldview, a rational worldview, has to explain, it has to provide a basis for reason. And he doesn't think that works in naturalism. And then our sixth point last time is that even with the divisions within Christendom, that Lewis wrote a book, Mere Christianity, and he says that there remains significant common ground. And so a idea of ecumenism, that Christians share certain things in common, is a very significant idea in C.S. Lewis. And Joe, that leads us to our second six.
All right.
Well, you know, one of the things that I want to say is that Lewis talks about things that are very important to all of us. And one of the things that he talks a lot about is pain and suffering. In fact, he has a book that came out in 1940 entitled The Problem of Pain. And then later in his life, you know, he gets married. He's a lifelong bachelor. And late in life, he marries this woman, this American woman, Joy Gresham Davidman, and they get married. And ultimately, Joy develops cancer and dies. And so Lewis goes through great grief. And we see this in The Grief Observed. Some people say, by the way, that you need to read those books together. You need to read The Problem of Pain and A Grief Observed together, because in A Problem of Pain, you get kind of a philosophical analysis of the philosophical problem of pain, suffering, and evil, or a theodicy. But in A Grief Observed, you get the direct experience of what it's like to lose someone you deeply love. And I think that's good advice, to read those together. Well, in talking about pain and suffering, Lewis writes this in The Problem of Pain. And this is a passage that grips me. He says this, he says, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. I love that. Let me read it again. God whispers to us in our pleasure, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. You know, there are things in life that I enjoy. I like baseball. I probably would rather watch a basketball game, but there's something about baseball, the history of the game. It is a truly American game. It goes back to the Civil War. It goes through the Great Depression and World War II. There's something about baseball that brings me pleasure. And I think, wow, the Lord allows all of humanity to have things in life that bring them pleasure. Another thing that brings me pleasure is talking with my family about ideas. When my kids were younger, I would take them to the movies, and I always enjoyed the ride home where we would talk about the ideas in the film. Well, there are pleasures in life. And I think God's speaking to us in those pleasures. But when it comes to a more commanding voice, he speaks in our conscience. I mean, when I'm at church and we go through the Ten Commandments and we say, Lord, have mercy on us and incline our will to keep thy law, there are times where my conscience speaks. You know, there have been times in my life where I have not honored my mother and father the way I should have. There have been times in my life where I have not been as honest as I should be. Well, God speaks in our conscience. And then Lewis says, but he shouts in our pains. It's his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. I find this very powerful. And it brings me back again to St. Augustine. And C.S. Lewis was a student of St. Augustine. Augustine, I think, would look at the problem of pain and suffering and evil, that it's a severe mercy. That is, there are things in life that hurt. To be involved in an accident where you maybe can't walk, or maybe to have COVID-19, or to lose a loved one to COVID-19. There are difficult things in life, and they hurt. So that's a severity, but Augustine would say they're a severe mercy, because without pain and suffering and evil, you may not be tethered to God. And, you know, I do wonder about the last moments of people's lives. What do they say? What do they think? Who do they call out to at that time when they realize they're not the captain of their own fate and their life is coming to an end? Is it going to end in darkness, where there's no life after death? Or will they come into the presence of God? Will they see their loved ones again? My old Bible teacher, Walter Martin, who, by the way, likes C.S. Lewis as well, the original Bible Answer Man, Walter used to say in his sermons that most people won't look up until they're flat on their back. Maybe suffering is a severe mercy. Maybe suffering is God's way of getting your attention. So he whispers to us in our pleasures. Pleasures are good. He speaks in our conscience. Boy, I read the law and I'm a lawbreaker. I am a guilty sinner. And God's word speaks powerfully to me. But I also know what it's like to suffer and to hear that that voice of pain in your life. Guys, I think that this is a very powerful point, and I think Lewis certainly thought that any viable worldview had to have some explanation as to why there is evil, pain, and suffering, and how to navigate through it. And, Lewis had a lot of suffering in his life. He lost his mother at 9 years old. He said his world was never stable after that. He, as a young guy, 19 years old, was a soldier in the First World War. And I don't know that any of us know what it's like to have been in the trenches in that terrible First World War. And, he had health problems. He lost his wife. He was passed over many times at Oxford. I think in many ways, there was a certain amount of jealousy of Lewis at Oxford. He was, after all, a Christian, and not everybody there was. And he became famous, and that kind of disturbed certain people. So, he was shy and had social anxiety. I never think of Lewis that way, but I think a case can be made. And so, pain and suffering is a megaphone. That's the way God gets attention. Now, let me bring you back to that point, though. I think it's good to read both the problem of pain and a grief observed, because, we don't want to walk into somebody's life when they're going through a difficult time and saying, well, God's just getting your attention. Mm. We want to have empathy. We want to care for people, but I think there is a truth in all of this, and this has been something that has stayed with me, and I love the way Lewis characterizes this.
Yeah, and this goes back to a point you made on the previous podcast, that these are helpful things to think about that we can use in our apologetic encounters or just being a Christian in front of other people who are not, but not any one of them is meant to be a knockdown, drag out argument, as you just stated. In the case of somebody who is self-sufficient and they have everything, God very well could be using an illness to knock them down and get their attention because they're arrogant and proud and that kind of thing. On the other hand, you could have a young parent who has a very sick child, or perhaps they lost a child to cancer or something. that's a different situation requiring, you know, maybe more listening than saying anything.
I think you're right on target, Joe. I think that we need to think about apologetic arguments and apologetic reasoning as tools. There is no silver bullet. None of these arguments are you know, foolproof. There's often comebacks that people have, apologetics. It can be tiring and fatiguing. It can also, you also realize that you need to rely upon the grace of God and, you know, the existential things. There are a lot of people suffering in life. And I remember when I was hospitalized, it kind of changed me. I think before I had a major illness, I thought, really, you know, the brave people in life are the soldiers, the policemen, the firemen, you know, that lay down their lives every day. I realized there are a lot of sick people in the world, and just trying to live day to day, they show a lot of courage. And so I love what Lewis is doing here. He speaks to us in our pain, and he gives us reason to trust the Lord. So yeah, I think I like your point. These are, I think Lewis would give us these arguments and ideas as tools, as pointers, not knock down arguments, but as pointers to God.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to just mention that there are two times particularly in my life where I went through some very difficult things with our family. And while I don't look forward to having that happen again, it certainly made an impact on me. It changed the way that I thought about things. And I wouldn't want to trade the experience for anything.
Yeah. I mean, there are these lessons, and I like the way you put it, Dave. It's not something you want to go through again, but you wouldn't have missed it because of the opportunities to grow in character and trust for God. Yeah. I remember a pastor saying to one of my friends who had lost his job, he said, "What's happening here?" And, you know, the pastor said, "You know, this may be an opportunity where you'll begin to see God's providence, that God does care for you." And I thought, wow, you know, seeing this difficulty as an opportunity to see God's hand in our life, because he does care about us, and he cares about, you know, our need for work and employment. Well, we're working through our second six. So this would be our second one here, but number eight overall. I think Lewis reminds us that good philosophy must exist to answer bad philosophy. And here I'm going to quote from The Weight of Glory. Lewis says, "To be ignorant and simple now, not to be able to meet the enemies on their own ground, would be to throw down our weapons and to betray our uneducated brethren, who have under God no defense but us against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered." You know, Lewis studied philosophy, and of course he studied literature, and he realized that we live in a world where people are proposing different ideas. People have differing ideas of truth, and people are out there advocating those views. And I think he touches upon a point here that's very good. And that is that philosophy is, you know, sometimes people will raise the ancient criticism, does philosophy bake any bread? And, you know, I have struggled in my earlier life with getting a philosophy degree. You know, how much money will I make? I remember one person pointing out that if you graduated from MIT with a graduate degree in engineering, you might make three times what somebody would with a degree in philosophy. And that is a challenge for many people. I want to pick a career that I can raise a family and I can, you know, have a good income. I think that's right. I think there are times where, you know, philosophy is seen as one of those degrees that may not give you a lot of opportunity in life. But if you think about it in terms of ideas, you know, there are a lot of philosophical ideas out there, and a lot of them are bad philosophical ideas. And the only way you can get into the weeds with philosophical ideas is to have some philosophical facility. You know, Lewis says that, you know, there are times where we need philosophy. We need to develop arguments. And, you know, I think it is proper to say that we are involved in a war. It's a spiritual war. It is a battle between truth and falsity, between good and bad, between God and the forces that stand against the Lord. And I like what he says here that, you know, we need to engage in the battle. And he argues that oftentimes the objections are philosophical in nature. And by the way, I get that from Hugh and Fuzz and Jeff. When they go out and give talks about science, they often tell me later that most of the questions were philosophical in nature. So I appreciate Lewis's recognition of the value of philosophy, its need, and just the need to be able to think carefully and think critically about these ideas. Again, you can overstate the need for apologetics. I think there are people that go through life and probably never read any apologetic books, and some of them are Christians and they do pretty well in life. But oftentimes people raise objections, particularly with young people. I mean, we seem to have an epidemic of young people being born into Christian families, growing up, going away to college, and then losing their faith. So I think in many ways, Lewis realized that there was a need for apologetics, and there is a need to respond to skeptical arguments. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's the definition of apologetics, guys. It's challenging unbelief, but also encouraging faith and encouraging people to grow in their relationship with God.
Yeah. Just to buttress your point and give a plug for a course here at RTB, you've taught for many years a course through Reasons Institute here at Reasons to Believe on critical thinking, and it remains one of the most popular courses we offer here. That is a way for somebody who might be new to this podcast to get up to speed on philosophy, because someone might be thinking, I can't go out and get a PhD or an MA or whatever it is, master's degree. I just don't have the time, the money, but it doesn't necessarily take that. I always like to hear you talk about this instance where you were debating or discussing in some manner a skeptic from, I think it was University of California at Fresno, or Fresno State, excuse me. I believe he's a biologist, a skeptic, and this was on scientific reasons, you know, that overcome the Christian faith or whatever. But he led off with a statement to the effect that I have no beliefs. And I love the way you just unpack that. It's like, wait a second. I mean, there he led with a philosophical statement.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is interesting to me how often people who have advanced degrees in science fail to realize the philosophical assumptions and starting points of science. And, you know, I love that class that we offer through Reasons Institute. It is a course on critical thinking. You know, we had one young lady, Jessica, who works at RTB, and she took the class, and, you know, she said, I'm taking it because I, you know, there are all these great books that RTB recommends, and I feel kind of intimidated to pick them up and read them. And I'm not sure how to kind of organize my thinking. And, you know, I have to say, having presented the lectures in that class and then overseeing the class, Jessica grew so much. You know, I could see she was really empowered. She wanted to read some of these great books. And, you know, that's exactly right. I mean, when good apologetics, good philosophy, good science, when you have a good education, it empowers you. And I have to say, I've been teaching logic since 1990. So that's more than 30 years. Of all the classes I've ever taught, it's always the logic critical thinking class where students come to me later and say, I feel empowered. I actually feel I have an ability, a skill, you know, to evaluate things that I didn't have previously. And I think that's what Lewis is talking about. And I think that's what Reasons to Believe wants to help people, to give them a skill set that they can then use in evangelism, in their faith. And again, I come back to that. Apologetics, I think, really involves three things. Challenging unbelief, encouraging the faith of Christians, and then helping them to grow in a life of dedication to the Lord. I think that's really that three-pronged process of doing apologetics.
All right, good.
All right, well, we're up to number three on our list, number nine overall in terms of my 12 things that I've learned from reading C.S. Lewis. And this one is that reason alone, apart from accompanying divine grace, has limited persuasive appeal. Now, I think this is interesting because C.S. Lewis is known as a great apologist. But if you read his writings, he's very clear that apologetics is a tool. And it's not a be-all and an end-all. In fact, here's what he says in God in the Dock. He says, quote, I have found that nothing is more dangerous to one's own faith than the work of an apologist. No doctrine of the faith seems to me so spectral, so unreal, as the one that I have just successfully defended in a public debate. For a moment, you see, it has seemed to rest on oneself. As a result, when you go away from the debate, it seems no stronger than the weak pillar. Well, I think that's right. I think there are times where we begin to realize that, you know, if Christianity is merely a series of arguments or a series of making a case, well, there's always a case and then a counter case. There is always pushback to all of these types of things. And I think Lewis makes a very powerful point, and that is that divine grace is what allows a person to recognize his need for God. And, you know, you have to come to God on God's terms. You can't come on your terms. And to come to God on your on his terms means humility. It means to recognize our brokenness and our fallenness. Lewis believed in divine grace. He believed that God was at work behind the scenes. He believed that God was pursuing him, not that he was necessarily pursuing God. And I really love that about C.S. Lewis, that even though he's well known and was well educated and is, in the view of many people, the best apologist of the 20th century, he realizes that it's not merely an argument, as valuable and as purposeful as those arguments are. It is an act of divine grace that must accompany these types of things. And that encourages us to pray for people. It encourages us to realize that, you know, we can't do without the Holy Spirit. the Holy Spirit has to be involved in these things. So I think that's kind of a wake-up call for us, that here's one of the great apologists who tells us apologetic arguments are not all there is. There's something more. All right. Well, we're making our way through here. Joe, I'm going to go to number 10. And that is the critical importance of reading old books. I love this about C.S. Lewis. In fact, he wrote an introduction to one of the great theological classics in Christian history. He wrote an introduction to Athanasius's book On the Incarnatius. Of course, Athanasius, the great church father of the fourth century, who defended Christianity against the Arian heresy and battled Arianism for 50 years. I was, by the way, baptized at a Catholic church in Long Beach entitled St. Athanasius Catholic Church. And on the front door, it says Athanasius Contra Mundum, Athanasius against the world. Well, Lewis has some great things to say about the importance of reading books, reading classic books. And here's a comment that he makes in that introduction to Athanasius's work. He says, a new book is still on its trial, and the amateur is not in a position to judge it. It is a good rule after reading a new book, never to allow yourself another one till you have read an old one in between. If that is too much for you, you should at least read one old one to every three new ones. Well, I appreciate that very much. By the way, another point that's on my list, and I'm just going to incorporate it here. Lewis often talked about the problem of chronological snobbery. It's very common for people to think that the time in which we live is superior to the past. That, you know, our world of advanced technology and living in this contemporary world, that we're smarter, we're better, we know a lot more than all those people in the Middle Ages or in the ancient world. Well, I think that Lewis pokes holes in that idea, and he tells us that there are great Christian books. There are great classic books. And rather than reading the one that's just come off, you know, the publishing press, maybe you want to go back and read some of the older books. And I'll tell you a little story. I was at Biola University teaching a course in their apologetics program. And so I started off my lecture by saying, well, who are your favorite apologists? And of course, immediately people mentioned J.P. Moreland, who has been a longtime professor there at Biola. They mentioned William Lane Craig, another distinguished contemporary Christian apologist and philosopher. I think one student mentioned Hugh Ross, the president of RTB, a scientist and Christian thinker. So I said, well, those are really good choices. I said, how about somebody from the past? Maybe you want to go a little deeper. So a person said, well, how about C.S. Lewis? And I said, well, that's great. But, you know, I was alive when C.S. Lewis was alive. I love Lewis, but what about some deeper folks? Well, could I say, a lot of times I wonder how many Christian apologists have read some of the classic books. I mean, how many have read On the Incarnation? That Lewis read it and he said, that's a masterpiece. How about Augustine's Confessions or The City of God? How about Anselm's Cur Deus Homo, Why the God Man? Lewis has done a lot to encourage me in reading. I appreciate very much that Mortimer Adler included one of Lewis's books in his great books of the Western world. And I've even thought, Joe and Dave, I've wondered who was the best read person of the 20th century. I'd like to give you two possible candidates. Mortimer Adler and C.S. Lewis. The breadth of things that they have read is really remarkable. And so Lewis has done a lot to encourage me to read some of the classics. And, you know, I'd like to challenge some of our people listening today. I know there are good authors writing today. I like it when you buy some of my books and read them very much. But I like what Lewis says here. Maybe before reading a new one, maybe you want to read an old one. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned in the previous program, Lewis said that he thought he could remember everything he ever read. So he would have his students go into his study, pick out a book and read a quote. And he would tell them, without knowing the title of the book, he would give them the title and provide a context for that quote. So he was a bookish man, and books played a very significant role in him coming to faith. I mean, we talk a lot about the role of Dyson and Tolkien and others in helping him come to Christianity. But it was also books that he was reading. Books play a great role in almost every conversion of a person who is an intellectual.
Sounds good.
The importance of really good books. All right. How about our fifth one for this program, our 11th overall. Again, 11, my top dozen reasons, my top dozen things I've learned from C.S. Lewis is our list, and I have a list of 25, so if you come on my Facebook page, you can pick up that whole list. But let me talk a little bit about Christianity Has the Best Story. I think really this takes us back to Lewis's general apologetic approach, that he believes that a worldview is viable if it has real explanatory power and scope, if it can provide an explanation of the big issues of life. And I like to use the word clear, C-L-E-A-R. And I use each of those letters as an area of life that needs to be explained. The C is the cosmos. A good worldview will explain where the cosmos came from, why it's there, why it's fine-tuned, why it's so habitable to human life. So a good worldview will give us insight as to where reality came from and why it's there. C, the cosmos. L, for life. It'll explain things about our life, our yearning, our searching, our need for love and truth and goodness and our existential context. Again, what is life all about? As Søren Kierkegaard said, the great Christian philosopher, I need a reason to live and a reason to die. You know, that there are a lot of people who don't have a reason to live, and so they commit suicide. We're living at a time in the pandemic where there are lots of people hurting, struggling with psychological challenges. I think Lewis would say Christianity gives you a reason to live, and when your life has come to an end, it gives you confidence in death. So C, cosmos, L, life. E, how about ethics? Where do I find moral goodness? Lewis talks a lot about that in Mere Christianity. He writes about it in other books as well. So where do I find moral values? And then the A in the word clear, abstractions. How can I discover reason and mathematics and logic? And then the R is religion. Why are human beings so darn religious? Why do we seem to have a need to worship? And then what about that person who appears in the Gospels, Jesus of Nazareth? what about his life, his teaching, his insight about the human condition, his ability to perform miracles, his will to lay down his life as a sacrifice, to allow human beings to be reconciled to God, his resurrection. I think Lewis, again, in saying that Christianity has this story, that it touches upon all of these particular areas. It gives us a reason to live, a reason to die. And again, I appreciate Lewis because he's always emphasizing the narrative. And he would say that there are lots of myths and legends that have been set forth in the world, but in many ways, those are pointers to the true myth. That is the reality where God entered the world in the womb of the Virgin Mary and became man, took upon a human nature, became the God-man. So this idea that Christianity is a worldview narrative, and it's able to explain things. I'm not sure we've done a good enough job presenting that story, communicating that story, but I think people like Lewis and Tolkien were able to do it through their fictional writings. I meet people who are very secular and they love Middle Earth. They love Narnia. They may not be tracking with the fact that Tolkien was Catholic and Lewis was an Anglican and had worldview ideas in there, but they're fascinated with this world of imagination that these two authors have been able to present. So my 11th point is Christianity has the best story. Okay, I'm gonna shoot for number 12 here, Joe and Dave. And I think it's a powerful one, and it's also a challenging one. There are going to be pushback on the part of people who hold different worldviews, particularly secular atheistic naturalism. But my 12th reason for the 12th thing that has meant so much to me in reading Lewis is that meaningless creatures would never discover their meaningless state. Let me state that again. Meaningless creatures would never discover their meaningless state. Now, I think this is a powerful position, and it's controversial. Not everybody is going to agree. Not even some Christian thinkers agree with this, but I think Lewis is right. He's persuaded me. And it's essentially this idea that if there's no God, if there's no mind behind the universe, you know, you can set it up. You can look at the world through the prism of two pairs of glasses. The theistic pair, the Judeo-Christian view, the biblical view is that a mind created nature. Therefore, we should be able to detect in that world things like morality and reason and goodness and beauty and truth, because they flow from the creator. So truth, goodness, and beauty from a creator, a mind. And it's not a surprise that we have minds. It's not a surprise that we're people, because the source of our personhood, the source of our rationality comes from God. But then there's that secular prism, that second pair of glasses that says, no, nature created mind. You know, there is no God. Why is the world here? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's a brute reality, or maybe there is a world ensemble. And what's the ultimate beginning point of that? Well, we don't know. Maybe the world is very complex, but it's still secular. So truth, goodness, and beauty. Well, can you have truth, goodness, and beauty in a world without God? Can there be objective truth? Can there be objective ethics or goodness? Can there be a ultimate standard of beauty in that world? Secular people disagree. There are some secularists who say, no, you can have truth, goodness, and beauty in a world without God. There are other secularists who say, no, you can't. Yeah, and you're stuck where you are. I remember Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existential atheist, he says, we live in a meaningless universe and there's no exit. Well, here's what Lewis says in Mere Christianity. He says, if the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Just as if there were no light in the universe and therefore no creatures with eyes, we should have never known that it was dark. Dark would be without meaning. Now, again, this is a bit controversial. Are we saying that if God doesn't exist, life has no ultimate meaning? I think that's exactly what we're saying. I think the thing that the naturalists really struggle with is three things: explaining reason, explaining ethics, and explaining meaning. There have been a lot of secularists who've said similar things. Nietzsche, living in the 19th century, he said, look, Western civilization is built on the truths of Christianity, but we no longer believe in the Christian God. But that's the source of our view of science. That's the source of our values. How do we live in a world that's built on the structure of God when we no longer believe in God? And he, of course, says, well, like Sartre, Nietzsche says, you can commit suicide or you can become the Übermensch, the overman. You can go out and create your own meaning. You create truth, goodness, and beauty for yourself because God's not there to do it for you. Well, I have lots of questions about that. Do you have the kind of requisite control in order to go out and create truth, goodness, and beauty? I mean, you had no say in that you exist. You had no say as to when you were born or the ideas you were exposed to. You have very little say about your death. None about the fact that you will die. I don't think that finite creatures can create truth, goodness, and beauty. Again, Lewis says this, if the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Just as if there were no light in the universe and therefore no creatures with eyes, we should never know it was dark. Dark would be without meaning. You know, there's another passage in Mere Christianity where he says, do fish at the bottom of the ocean who have never been out of water, do they know what wetness is? Now, again, some people don't buy this. I do. I think it's a powerful way of pointing where does meaning and purpose come from, and can you create it? Can you get it without God?
Ken, if somebody says life has no meaning, is that not a meaningful statement? How would you respond to that?
I think that's touching upon the very point we're making here, Joe. To make the proclamation that life has no meaning is a very meaningful statement. And it creates this logical conflict. It falls back onto itself. To say that the universe, life has no meaning, wow, you've come to this meaningful... In fact, you've come to maybe the most meaningful recognition that life has no meaning. So in a naturalist worldview, it's a logical quagmire. Mm. But within theism, to say, no, there is meaning. And I may struggle with finding it, but maybe that's the very purpose of it. Again, none of these points are knocked down. I can probably easily find on the internet or social media or in reading good secular books, responses to them. And so you can always expect, if you're going to talk about these things, people are going to push back against them. But don't feel defeated. Don't feel like you have failed if not everybody accepts these ideas, because some of us do accept them. I mean, when I read that in Mere Christianity, I was like, wow, that is meaningful and purposeful to me. So Joe, Lewis has had a big influence on me, and not just me. And, you know, reading his books, again, it doesn't mean you have to agree with C.S. Lewis. For example, probably Lewis believed in evolution. Lewis, for example, probably didn't believe in biblical inerrancy. I mean, he came from a very secular perspective. But I think even if you realize that he may have been, he may have challenged some of your evangelical points of view, I think to be as conservative theologically that he was is really a miracle, because he lived at one of the most secular periods, that last half century of the 19th century into the 20th century is fiercely secular.
Yeah. So he's conservative now.
Ken, you know, so these are
things, one of the things that you find frequently is people will reject an idea based on some other ideas that they have. And what you discover is that they're always incomplete. They're not willing to look and say, well, maybe I don't have all the material that is necessary to make this conclusion. I was recently rereading the New Testament, and I think it's especially in the Gospel of John, where there's several places where they'll make statements like, we don't know where Jesus came from, and then they have some conclusion, we can't trust who he is. And then a little while later, well, we know where this guy came from, and he's not what he, and it's just these contradictory conclusions that people come to based on incomplete evidence. And it's just so frustrating at times.
Yeah, and I hear you. I think maybe it can be helpful to all of us who engage in evangelism, who study apologetics, who talk with other people about ideas. I think to realize that, we should expect that people will push back. Again, there's no silver bullet, no apologetic argument that works for everybody. People are persuaded by different things. People are at different stages of their life. God's grace, it is God's working power through the gospel message that draws people to himself. I think it's very easy to get into a conversation and feel really disappointed that maybe you don't feel like you have defended Christianity as well as you should, or it seems like nobody's listening. Well, remember, Jesus didn't have a lot of followers either.
No, that's right.
And he's God in human flesh. And, Paul goes into Athens and some of them listen, but most of them don't. And, we don't know what the Lord has to do to prepare people. But having said all of that, I still think we have the best story. I think we have the best case. I think we have some solid arguments. The most meaningful realities in the world make sense in light of the Christian worldview. And there's lots of evidence and arguments. So Lewis is a person, I think, that can help us in all of that kind of context. And, if I could, Joe, just say this. One of the things I like about the book I wrote, Classic Christian Thinkers, I mean, when you're an author, you, after it's done and published, you know, you, there are always things you find in it and you think, well, I could have said this better, or maybe, you know, maybe that argument I made wasn't as strong as it could have been or should have been, or maybe I should have had other sources. But one of the things I like about classic Christian thinkers, when I read through it, I really think I'm reading about my friends. These are Christian pilgrims who lived in the same world I did, and they belong to the same Lord that I do, and they had pain and suffering and difficulties and struggles, but they're, you know, they're models, they're friends, they're models, and I learn from them, and they all point me back, all of them point me back to the scriptures, to the person of Christ, and to the triune God. And I'm grateful for C.S. Lewis.
Good stuff. Thank you for the 12 points there, Ken. I think they are helpful, and they will really come to mind when some of us are out there talking to people, whether it be online or wherever. The fact that they're short, but you gave good explanations of them and how to use them, I think that will be helpful. I know it has been for me. So thank you for that. All right. We want to remind you, if you are listening and you have a comment, we appreciate receiving those. You can send your comments and questions to @RTB_KSamples. That's the usual way, Ken's Twitter handle. But some of you have been commenting on Facebook. That's great. Easy way to reach Ken there. Or commenting on Ken's blog, which comes out every other week, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com. Be sure to read Ken's reflections blog. Some more great stuff there as well. In fact, some people have written in, Ken, here a couple of comments that have come in. Here's one. I always enjoy listening to Straight Thinking. Blessings to you, Joe, Dave, and your families. Barry Wynn. Right. So, Dave, we got included in that one. How about that?
How about that?
Thank you, Barry. Here's another one. I want to thank you for your latest and best book, Christianity Cross-Examined. This book is the most thorough and concise book you have written, Lee Bush. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that, Lee. Ken, I'm sure you appreciate that. And here's another one on that same book. Christianity Cross-Examined is an excellent book, well worth taking the time to read. Dr. Robert W. Bowman, vicar at Christ Chapel Anglican. So thank you for those comments. I don't know if you want to say anything about those, Ken, or just receive them.
Yeah, you know, it's I can tell you that writing is a big challenge for me. It never comes out right the first time, and I'm envious of somebody like C.S. Lewis, but I think what's very encouraging is when you've worked really hard on an article or a book and somebody tells you, hey, that helped me, that encouraged me, I used it, and it gives me a lot of encouragement and satisfaction. So I appreciate these really, really wonderful comments. I find them very encouraging.
Great, thank you, and thank you for letting us know your thoughts. We certainly appreciate them. All right, that's going to wrap it up. Thanks for listening to this podcast. You can subscribe to the Reasons to Believe podcast on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts, and you'll get Straight Thinking delivered to you each week. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.